Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hello, folks, and welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our anchor sponsor, Gateway Marketing Cafe. If, like me, you're not much of a shopper and you want to give a gift that, well, it works for everyone, consider Gateway gift cards. They're great stocking stuffers, and they can be used at Gateway Market, Django, Centro, Zombie Burger, and any other Des Moines business in the Orchestrate network. So for every $100 you spend on gift cards, you also get an additional $20 card free. So if my kids are listening to this today's program, yeah, you're getting Gateway gift cards, again, like every year. Folks, you can pick them up at Gateway Market or any Orchestrate hospitality business, and mention you heard about them on the Fallon Forum. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry, who with 23 years of experience in the business. Joe is also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. I am delighted to welcome to the program Randy Evans, the former editorial page editor of the Des Moines Register, the founder of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council. Do I have that right?
The organization is right. I'm the third executive director.
Ah, okay. And I thought you were the founder.
No, we've been around for almost 50 years.
Well, you've raised so much of the profile so much higher with the work you've been doing to...
I'm taller.
You are taller and louder, maybe? And you have stray thoughts.
I have occasional
You have thoughts. A column called Stray Thoughts, which is a funny title. Because if anything, your thoughts seem to be very well collected and organized.
Well, at
not
least...
Not so stray.
At least part of me is organized then.
Well... I want to talk about the most recent column you wrote regarding, normally your columns are about local stuff, but this one is about the Caribbean Sea, Venezuela, the former president of Honduras, and the contrast between President Trump's response to boats in the Caribbean and, to some extent, in the Pacific Ocean, and his pardon of this former president of Honduras. I'll let you lay it out. I mean, you laid it out really well, and I thought it was something people should hear about.
I mean, it struck me the contradiction in the president's position. Nobody disputes the seriousness of drug addiction in the United States, the problem of illicit drugs, but I'm not sure that... gunning down people on the open sea is the solution. But for the sake of discussion, if the problem is so large that we want the United States military to do that, then help me understand, Mr. President, why we would be focusing on drug runners who are the lowest... people involved in the networking,
right?
Why we would be focusing on eliminating them, but then giving a free pass, if you will, to a wealthy drug kingpin who was found guilty following a trial
in the U.S.
in the United
right.
States, found guilty by a jury, and the judge sentenced this person to 45 years in prison. And he has been in prison months and is now free, a free man. The contradiction is just hard for me to fathom.
I would think it would be hard for anybody to fathom. I wonder, what are Republicans in Congress saying about it? Have we heard any response from them at all?
Well, you hear the response from Republicans has kind of evolved as people learn more about this, but it is not evolving in the way that common sense tells this old Iowa kid ought to be the reaction. We have them saying, you know, drugs are a serious problem and these people need to be eliminated. But for every 80 people that are being gunned down on boats in the Caribbean or in the Pacific, there's going to be some other poor Venezuelan who's going to climb on the next boat to make a delivery to someplace else. We're not going to be able to kill our way out of the drug problem.
But we don't even know whether these boats were actually carrying drugs. That's because we destroyed the evidence.
We destroyed evidence.
There's a history of how we deal with this in the past. The Coast Guard would stop the boat,
board it,
see what's on board, confiscate the contents if they are indeed illegal, mm-hmm. if they're drugs.
And gather the evidence that would be used to form the basis for a prosecution. And, you know, you go back to the war on drugs, you know, we in the United States have been preaching the message for years that we need to get to the people who are responsible. And it's not the guy who is sitting on the boat that is responsible. Yeah. It's the kingpins, the multimillionaire kingpins.
The president of Honduras.
The president, for example.
So now, to me, if you are intentionally destroying the entire boat, killing everybody on board, leaving no trace of what the cargo was, then you really don't have any confidence that it was indeed a boat transporting illegal drugs. I mean, you do that intentionally to avoid scrutiny of what you're doing. I mean, I don't see anything out of the way. If they really thought they had drug boats and drug dealers, they would be apprehending them, wouldn't they? Am I missing something?
This one time, Ed, you're not wrong.
Oh. Well, gosh, it was about time.
It stretches believability when the video of the killing of the survivors of the attack,
on
that
September
video
2nd, yep.
has not been made public. When our president makes statements that are demonstrably false, the credibility of the United States government has suffered.
Then why do too many people continue to believe anything he says? Why are there no members of Congress that I know of, Republican members of Congress, who are saying that, or are calling out these illegal boats, illegal strikes, who are challenging the president on his decision to pardon the former drug kingpin president of Honduras? I mean, and maybe there have been some Republicans in Congress who have called these things out. Other than Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm not sure who they are.
The number who have spoken up on the Republican side, you could probably have them in your living room comfortably.
We don't have that big of a living room.
I rest my case.
Yeah. But I mean, Ashley Hinson and Chuck Grassley have all come out in support of what the president's doing.
The problem from my vantage point is that where do you draw the line? If you're basing this on what you have learned without showing the evidence, as you would in a criminal trial, if you are killing people on the open seas, are we going to sort of authorize the military or police officers in South Florida to start gunning down people on the streets just because we believe they are trafficking drugs?
It's not a big stretch. It's not a big stretch.
But that's not the American way.
No,
and I worry
but it seems
that,
to be the Trump way.
I worry that we are eroding the stature of the United States of America when we start behaving this way internationally. It's almost as if we have not learned the lessons of history.
So freedom of information, you're all about that. Is there information relevant to these boat strikes that we should have the freedom to review, or has it all been destroyed? Is there nothing left to look at?
I mean, the problem with access to information, whether you're talking at the local level, the state level, or at the federal level, the fundamental problem is that government can dig in its heels and say, if you disagree, sue us. And that process is incredibly expensive and incredibly time-consuming.
And often uses a lot of black market for redactions.
And it's, you know, you inject the United States military into the equation, and it becomes even more difficult because of quote-unquote national security interests. I mean, I think the surest way to get the kind of transparency that is needed is through the United States Congress. And now we're back to the lack of curiosity, if you will.
That's a very friendly word to use for spying.
Well, the lack of curiosity on the part of members of Congress who are willing to accept the word of the president and his...
Well, not just accept it, but validate it. I mean, our own congressional delegation, the Republicans, seem to have no trouble with what Trump has done in the Caribbean Sea.
Well, and this is an instance where if the administration were sharing with congressional committees, the evidence that they have, you don't have to disclose publicly the sources and methods of gathering the information, the evidence, such as it is, but, you know, the whole approach of, trust me, I'm telling you the truth this time, we've been there.
Right. Or when somebody starts the word, to be honest.
To be honest.
When they start a sentence with, to be honest, you wonder how many times they haven't been honest prior to that sentence.
Well, I remember when, in the first Trump administration, when Kellyanne Conway started talking about alternative facts.
Right.
And, when you start introducing alternative facts into the discussion, people's believability suffers.
Yeah, how does that strike a journalist?
The hair on the back of my neck stands up.
Should get that shaved.
Well, that's...
Yeah. So anyway, right now there is a huge military buildup, U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean off the coast of Venezuela. Do you see an actual invasion of Venezuela as a likely next step in this escalating conflict?
I think if you've been around as long as I have, one of the things that you know for a certainty is that you have very little certainty about what's going to happen. I worry that our president, who seems to make decisions and then try to back away from them, is going to put us in a pickle where we're going to have men and women from Iowa and the other states who are serving in the military are going to be putting their lives at risk in a place that, our president assured us he was not going to get us into these foreign wars.
Right, regime change wars.
And how has that worked out in the past?
Yeah, it hasn't, yeah. No, I just, I am deeply concerned about where this is going. And I don't think it's about, I think it's about regime. I think it is about regime change. He does not like Maduro. He wants him gone.
I think he also wants, and he's spoken in the past about, we ought to benefit from these military actions where we get the wealth, the oil in this particular. He's not going into Venezuela because he wants the coffee beans.
Right. So, yeah, you think it is about oil as well as about regime change? I mean,
call me a fool.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly our policy in the Mideast over the past multiple decades has been about oil. So, again, shocks me is that Republican members of Congress who sometimes will say reasonable things are faced with a situation that is so unreasonable. I mean, there's no defensible argument for blowing up these boats. There's no defensible argument for freeing the former president of Honduras. I mean, there's no way you can defend that. And yet here they are refusing to criticize the president, refusing, you know, not declining to.
Well, I would like a rational explanation from the administration about why we're using the military in this kind of a role rather than using the U.S. Coast Guard, which has a long track record.
Right. And a very different approach.
Of taking a more police approach rather than a military approach, getting the drugs off of the market and learning from what you can learn from people who are alive and not dead at the bottom of the sea. Who are they working for? Which could help, deal with the drug trafficking issue in ways that killing one or two people on a boat here and one or two people on a boat over there isn't going to solve anything.
Yeah. Well, we'll see where this goes. Renee, I got to take a short break.
You're at that age, Ed.
And you're at that age plus a few years. But I want to talk about the something that happened, 50 years ago?
Closing in on that.
The bombing of the American Friends Service Committee building during the Vietnam War. You're going to be speaking about that. I think it'd be very interesting to hear your thoughts on that as somebody who lived nearby when it happened and somebody who has a long background in journalism. So let's have that conversation when we come back from a short break. This is Ed Fallon with you, with Randy Evans on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you folks. Thanks to our partners, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Western Optometry. Dr. Joel Western and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Western Optometry. All right, Randy Evans is with me, again, former editorial page editor of the Des Moines Register, director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, and also regular author of a column called Stray Thoughts, which I think is a little bit funny, since your thoughts tend not to be very stray at all. They tend to be very focused.
They're leashed.
Leashed. Well, good, they ought to be leashed and curbed. There's nothing worse than a stray thought straying onto, anyway, that metaphor has already run its course. So you were around, how many years ago was it when, during the Vietnam War, because of its opposition to the Vietnam War, the American Friends Service Committee building, again, think Quakers, was bombed. I mean, not just a little, you know, token bomb, but a big bomb.
Well, I mean, this occurred at a time in our history when, you know, these kinds of bombings were occurring with troubling frequency around the United States. You know, the Des Moines Police Department, a bomb there. Drake University, one of the buildings there was bombed.
Who bombed the police department?
I'm not sure if they ever, I don't believe the charges were ever.
Now how about Drake?
Again, you know, these are incredibly difficult crimes to investigate because the evidence is gone. But it, you know, we talk these days like the division in the United States is unparalleled. But, you know, those of us who have more white hair than dark hair remember...
Some of us, no hair.
Well, I didn't want to be too observant there. But, you know, at that era, the Vietnam War was an incredibly stressful time in the United States history where there were strong opinions on both sides of the issue. And the involvement of the American Friends Service Committee in some of these pacifist kinds of activities wasn't setting well with a segment.
Yeah, and they were nonviolent action opposed to the war,
mm-hmm.
and you lived nearby. At the time.
Well, I didn't live near enough.
Not near enough to get blown up, but near enough to hear it.
Well, by the time I got there, I was pretty well winded. I lived at 28th and on 28th Street between Grand and Ingersoll, and the explosion that evening was so loud that I was convinced that it was just a short distance away, and I knew as a reporter... That I needed to be there.
So you were reporting for the Des Moines Register.
Correct.
At the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how old were you? Curious.
Oh, 24, 25.
Okay. And you still were out of breath just running 12 blocks?
Oh, it was more than 12.
Well, 28th Street, 42nd, do the math.
Oh.
Oh, 14, you're right.
Oh, well.
14
well,
blocks.
Then... As now, most of my exercise came from jumping to conclusions. But it's, you know, so I took off on foot with my notebook and pens in hand and started running, and people think Ingersoll is flat.
No, we know. We hear no better.
It's uphill the whole way.
Both directions.
And, you know, so I was there. I, you know, it was a huge story, and...
What did you see when you got there?
There were police, fire, lots of people.
A smoldering building?
And more questions than answers. Hmm. And that has lasted through the years. I mean, you know, people who were closely associated with the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers... You know, they're still wondering who was behind this. What was the motivation?
Yeah, well, it had to be presumably somebody who supported the war effort and was not pleased with
right.
voices of peace.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe part of the question is why was not more done to try to track them down? Is that
well? But I think that you know, I think we see. Every day there are lots of crimes that occur in Iowa, in the United States, where it you know, in spite of the best efforts of law enforcement, you know, they don't have the evidence that they need to build a case.
Right, right.
And, you know, I think, you know, if I veer off on a tangent here, this is one of the reasons that, you know, some law enforcement officials are concerned about a close relationship between local police agencies and federal immigration officials, mm-hmm. ICE, because if local police are seen as an extension of ICE,
they won't be trusted.
They're not going to be trusted. People who have knowledge or may have information that would be helpful for an investigation aren't going to share it with law enforcement. So it's, you know, solving crimes is no no easy task. And, I mean, you look at the Unabomber. I mean, it was only through, you know, almost a quirk of the Unabomber's brother just having some suspicions and taking those to law enforcement that solves a almost 20-year-old mystery.
Yeah, that would have ruined their Thanksgiving dinner, wouldn't it?
Taken off the Christmas card list.
Yeah. So you ended up writing a story about this.
I was one of a number of registered reporters who contributed, you know, to show you how the business of news gathering has changed. You know, as I was hot-footing it up Ingersoll, my head was swiveling as I was trying to spot where payphones would be because, you know, cell phones were still in the future.
Yeah.
I have dictated complete stories or I've dictated, you know, bits of information and have it stitched together by somebody back at the office. And, you know, this was one of the stories where the stitching was done back at the Register newsroom.
You had to run back down the hill.
Well, one of the things that you also learned to do, which these days would probably get you shot, you'd go up and just knock on a door and say, you know, I'm from the Register. Could I borrow your phone?
Right.
So, you know, if you hear a knock on the door some evening, Ed, I'm just here to borrow the phone.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it'll have to be a knock on the door because we don't have a doorbell. So the so what kind of damage was done to the building? Do we know?
Well, I mean, it was extensive damage, but
nobody was hurt. Correct.
Right. I mean, it was, you know, at a different time of day. You know, the
staff had all left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's you know, among the questions is, was that just good fortune on the public's part, or was that
benevolence on the part of the bombers?
Yeah, who was in wanting to intimidate, but not, you know, kill.
Right.
But I think that one of the lessons to take away from that is that, you know, we ought to be mindful of the events that we're living in and not present them in ways that we think that this is unique and unusual.
Back to your point about the division in our times, mm-hmm. that there was plenty of division.
There was plenty of division back then.
And I mean, there's always division wherever there's people.
But I think
there's division.
But I think
that said,
you know, you look at you know, the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the you know, pardons were in the news back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the draft resistors were pardoned as part of the healing process. I'm not sure that pardoning a Honduran drug lord is helping the healing
it's
of...
It's exacerbating the problem. It's creating greater divisions. And I would say, I was around then too, younger, more capable of running 14 blocks without getting winded. So I'm
show off.
Keep teasing you about that.
Show
but,
off.
But also, I don't think it was as bad then as it is now.
I think there were strongly held opinions on both sides of the whole war issue. But I think, one of the... there ought to be a cautionary tale in the use of National Guard on the streets of American cities these days, the use of the military domestically these days. I take you back to Kent State University, mm-hmm. where, five or six people shot because the Ohio National Guard soldiers, did not exercise good judgment. And you had innocent students gunned down on a college campus.
Yeah. Four, I believe. But yeah, it was terrible. There's so much good and bad in our history. And we tend to focus on the bad because, for various reasons. But I think one reason is we hopefully can learn from it.
Yes. But I think what concerns me is when our leaders, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or Whigs, don't
you're dating yourself.
Don't learn from history because they've never really paid attention to it.
Yeah.
And you look back at the Vietnam era. And you had people who were Republicans, and you had people who were Democrats, who were not afraid to grill the administration mm-hmm. about decisions that were being made. These days, I see precious little willingness on the part of political leaders who are in the majority.
The Republican Party.
To ask questions, to demand answers from the administration. So
related to that, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I never thought I'd say I was sorry to see her resign. I am. And she's done gone through an interesting evolution, if we take it at face value, which I do, and maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I believe she's sincere. One thing she said was, "I regret being so caustic," something to that effect. She regrets playing into the politics of division. And she just recently, last weekend, did an interview with Leslie, forget her last name, on 60
Leslie
Minutes.
Leslie Stahl.
So, yeah, on 60 Minutes. And it's pretty insightful.
Yeah, yeah.
And why is her rebellion against Trump's authority so unique within the Republican Party? And rebellion in her case, somebody who was seen as kind of her right-hand ally.
Well, and this could be a financially costly decision on her part because, she was in there, in a comfortable office where she could have been there for who knows how long, but she's walking away from that.
Yeah.
Chuck Grassley, who has nothing to worry about financially, has torpedoed, poor choice of words, his reputation that he had earned early on in his career.
I once voted for Grassley because he was
independent. I did too.
Independent.
He was not afraid to ask questions, ask why, but he has no curiosity now about...
Yeah. Yeah.
Why we are, we're bombing boats, or why we aren't using the Coast Guard. I've come full circle now.
Yeah, you have, but that's okay. That's a good place to be. And I think lessons from the bombing of the American Friends Service Committee. There has always been division in this country, But beyond that, we're at a particularly divisive moment, and we should be encouraging more people to think independently, to reread history.
And to talk to each other.
And to talk to each other, which what I spent all of October trying to do.
Because I think that from making those personal connections are the way that we appreciate each other's views.
Yeah. Yep. Hey, Randy, thank you so much for joining us. Randy Evans, folks. Ed Fallon with you here on the Fallon Forum. Got to take a short break. When we come back, Kathy and I are going to discuss public education. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
All right, hey, Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Welcome back. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. Hey, we're going to be reviewing a piece in the New York Times, and Kathy Burns is with me to help with this because she had, 16 years? 14 years.
I'm not that heroic.
Well, 14 years in the public school system is pretty heroic.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And, education in Iowa has been a big thing. In fact, it was our state quarter, leader in education, I think was the motto on the quarter years ago. But this piece raises a lot of concerns, and I want to just kind of read through it, and then we can stop and, you know, and discuss it as we move along.
Okay.
Anyway, it's an editorial that's referencing work by a reporter named Gia Lin. The numbers are staggering. Nearly one in four 17-year-old boys in the U.S. has attention deficit hyperactive disorder, ADHD. I mean,
well,
it's disturbing, but my thought is ADHD is actually a normal condition that we aren't meant to sit still forever, all day long, doing the same task.
Technically, there is a difference between wanting to move your body on a regular basis and the inability to be still for a certain amount of time. So I think what you're saying is that yes, we need to be up and active, and that's the best way to learn things. But
especially for younger kids.
But we really don't have any data on whether these conditions, hyperactivity, attention deficit, in other words, just wanting to think of other things than what's being presented, whether they've always existed, and if they've affected children and families for years without kind of categorizing it as something we could help people with, or something we could, information that we could use to reform education to more accommodate children who don't sit still well, and I'm one of those.
Yeah, well, you and me both. So the editorial continues. In the early 1980s, a diagnosis of autism was delivered to one child in every 2,500. That figure now is one in every 31. Almost 32% of adolescents have at some point been given a diagnosis of anxiety. More than 1 in 10 have experienced a major depressive disorder. Your thoughts on that? I mean, there's a bunch of different things thrown together.
This article does focus on the school system and its impact on children's mental health overall. However, in response to those data, I would say that there's a lot more that children feel stressed and confused about than just what's happening at school and the structure of the public school system. There's economics, there's the lack of families to, whether it's a one parent, two parent, whatever kind of family it is, to be home with the children on a regular basis. We work ourselves to death in this country because of the economic system, the social expectations. And so I wouldn't just blanket that all of that data and say we need to figure out how the school system is causing this.
Yeah, and I'm not sure the author of the piece intends to do that. Mm-hmm. The piece continues, why did this happen? A lot of reasons. Kids spent hours on screens, cutting into their sleep, exercise, and socializing. Mm-hmm. Activities that can ward off anxiety and depression. Mental health screenings have improved.
Yes.
So two things there.
Yes.
Screen time, bad. Mental health screenings,
good.
Better, good, good. Yeah. The piece continues, and then there's school itself, a cause of stress for many children, and the very place it sends them toward a diagnosis. And we can read more about what they say about that, but mm-hmm. your initial take, maybe that's being too hard on schools?
I'll backtrack with a little note that being a public educator, an educator of any kind of our precious children, is a nearly impossible task to do successfully all the time. And educators face scrutinization, criticism, and they also get some kudos. But when you think about the stress on the teachers to accomplish all that they're expected to do in a day, it's not surprising that some of this also affects the children and their learning. Every child has a different learning style, and teachers are expected to teach to the style of learning. And with, 15, 20 more children in a classroom, you can kind of categorize different learning styles as someone who's more tactile, someone who's more visual, and that's a very generic way to look at it. But that stress alone and the teacher's ability to accommodate that or not can also make the school system feel stressful for the kids.
Yeah, and let me read more from the piece because I think it gets into an element that feeds right into what you're just talking about there. So in 1950, less than half of American children attended kindergarten. I was one of them. Only about 50% graduated from high school. After school hours were filled with play or work. But as the country's economy shifted from factories and farms to offices, being a student became a more serious matter. The outcome of your life could depend on it. College became a reliable path to the middle class. And schools leaned into the new standards of testing and put in place, for example, No Child Left Behind. That was in 2002. I know. And I one teacher friend of mine called it No Teacher Left Standing. But the whole idea is that, we have to have, this is kind of related to my previous conversation with Brittany, this need for national standards, for standardizing everything, for finding a way to measure it, to make it easy and convenient for people who want to analyze data. And is that kind of what's happened with No Child Left Behind?
Very much so. I think No Child Left Behind was the culmination of the previous years-long pressure on schools to respond to the business world, the academic world, the world that wants kids to be ready for jobs. The corporate world, either when they graduate high school or when they, quote, go to college, and for a long time trade schools were left out of secondary education or higher education learning. All of that pressure then was part of the No Child Left Behind then was established as part of the public demand for schools to get kids ready to work and ready to produce and ready to be part of our community, but the developing the child as a whole was left behind. Mm. That's what was left behind. Yeah. All the children were left behind.
And to remind people, I mean, Nickleby, No Child Left Behind, was co-sponsored by two politicians that I happen to like.
I'm sure.
Ted Kennedy on the Democratic side, mm-hmm. and John McCain on the Republican side.
They had good intentions, but I'm sure they were responding to a demand that presented what seemed to be rational ideas without looking at the needs of the business community, yeah. and the corporate world instead of the needs of the children to develop, yeah. into the people they will become.
That to me is the underlying problem with facing public education right now, is the demands that the corporate community have placed.
Thank you for acknowledging that, because a lot of people say the problem with public education. And public education is so near and dear to my heart. I mean, all children deserve the same chances and chances that fit their needs, not just, nothing against, private education, that's great. But to put so much blame on public education for the woes of the world right now and the woes of America right now is extremely brutal.
So back to the New York Times piece. States rewarded schools for having high scores. They punished schools for low ones. Schools were treated more like publicly traded companies with test scores as proxies for profits. Before long, schools had public ratings so ubiquitous they now appear on real estate listings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that says it all right there.
It does. And the way the scores were tallied and presented was not by these tests. What was important to the outcomes was not the raw scores of the student. In other words, if you took a test and you got 75% of the things on it right, you were not granted, and the schools were not granted, how well are the kids doing overall, but how do they compare with all the other schools?
Competitive,
in percentiles.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if your school ranks in the 50th percentile, it's doing better than 50% of the other schools, and then all the schools get better equally the next year, that school will not look like it raised its right. quality of education or outcomes at all. If the kids start performing at 75% or 90% of the questions answered right, and all the other schools did the same thing, that first school will still be in the 50th percentile, looking like they're not growing and learning.
Let me continue with the editorial. And there were clear incentives to diagnose students with psychiatric disorders. Treatment of one student, especially a disruptive one, could lead to higher test scores across the classroom. And in some states, the test scores of students with a diagnosis weren't counted toward a school's overall marks, nudging results higher as well. Was that your experience?
There were students who, if they could be qualified as having a condition that kept them from achievement at that time in their lives in the school system, yes, they were allowed to be excluded from the overall school reporting so that they wouldn't pull the average down for everybody
else. Which again, as the piece says, encourage the use of diagnoses.
Maybe. Mm. I mean, incentives, maybe motivation. I'm not sure. That seems a little harsh, but I never saw a lot of students willy-nilly being labeled or diagnosed as something but I did see students whose scores were pulled out.
Right. Well, to continue the effect, the piece writes about the effect on kids. The pressures on students became extreme. In 2020, Yale researchers found that nearly 80% of high schoolers said they were stressed, and that stress has trickled down to younger and younger kids. Kindergartners learn best through play, not through the rote lessons in math and reading that began to enter classrooms. Preschoolers are not predisposed to sitting still. And yet,
correct.
As they too now face greater academic expectations, many are being expelled for misbehavior. Even the school day became more regimented with fewer periods of recess. By 2016, only 8 states had mandatory recess in elementary schools. Class schedules are packed. You've got 7 different homework assignments that you've got to remember each night, one expert told the reporter. Think of the cognitive load of a 6th grade boy. I challenge many adults to do this.
All of that it speaks to truth. I do want to just think about some historical perspective on the demands of younger children. I'm thinking about my grandfather, who, you know, I'm writing a book about his life, and when he was taken in by a family at the age of 3, by the age of 6 or so, he was expected to toe the line for chores, for manners, for his religious education, and raised with a lot of stress and pressure, as a lot of other children were. So
A different kind of stress.
But I don't know if kids have more stress today, but that would be an interesting thing to really look into longitudinally.
Well, and there's a big time period between when your grandfather was dealing with that.
In the late 1800s.
And, yes. And now the 2010s. And, I would say that, I didn't really like school as a kid.
I know. You talk about it a lot.
But you like school.
Yes, I did. Even though I don't sit still well, I was very good behavior oriented.
Yeah.
I wanted to please.
I didn't like school because I didn't like getting beaten by nuns.
No.
And also I found the curriculum in high school extremely boring and irrelevant. But I wouldn't say that it stressed me like I see, the analysis of today.
I had kind nuns by junior high and high school when I was in public education. I enjoyed learning because I had an exceptional environment for learning, Harlan Community High School, Harlan Community Schools in general. And I had a group of friends who challenged each other to do well, and we were excited about learning together. Mm. And I don't know if that's, and it wasn't necessarily a small school. We had 200 or so in my graduating class, but it was an active learning environment with a lot of great extracurriculars. So I had a very different experience.
I'm jealous, but it seems to me like even that is slipping away.
Nowadays. Maybe. Yeah. I think it's a different pressure on kids to do something different than just learn and enjoy.
Well, interesting stuff. We could talk a lot more about this, but that's a good start. Kathy, thank you so much for helping to research this conversation. And stick around, Kathy. We'll be back in a minute, folks. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the final segment of the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact DavidDrakeFamilyPsychiatry.com. All right, Kathy, sticking around with me here for another farm and food conversation.
Yet another.
You were at the Iowa Farmers Union Convention. Several lawmakers spoke on issues of food security and sustainability. Mm-hmm. What's your takeaway from their presentation?
Well, it was pretty interesting. And as I said last week, I can't credit myself for having captured all of the statements that we can talk about because I was looking at the article by Cami Coons, the agricultural and environmental reporter for the Iowa Capital Dispatch. So thank you, Cami. And she was also named Ag Journalist of the Year by the the convention. So it was pretty good. The legislators talked about food, nutrition, and three specific themes: childhood nutrition, food education, and local food policy. So just really quickly, Ed, I thought I could give one of the quotes from one of the four legislators who were there, and we could discuss it. But some of it's not a direct quote. It's a paraphrase.
Paraphrase is fine.
Yeah. So in the category of child nutrition, as we talked about last week, the Healthy Kids Iowa program, Governor Reynolds' alternative program to the federal SNAP summer benefits program. The senator from, well, I can't remember where she's from, I think, but Annette Sweeney, Republican, her comment was something similar to programs like Healthy Kids Iowa allow for greater localization of food assistance, and noted that local individuals can monitor the programs and advocate for adjustments in order to better serve their recipients.
Okay.
Sounds nice.
Yeah, except if you really know that it's another way of taking away parental authority.
Yes.
And creating bureaucracy.
I mean,
Republicans are supposed to hate, you know, taking away local authority and hate bureaucracy. And here's a program that does the opposite. You know,
just, right.
So I guess you can call that local because you're refusing federal funds.
Yes, you are.
I'm curious what the Democrat response to that was.
Well, Representative Beth Wessel Crochelle, Democrat, she was referring to the recent restrictions to SNAP benefits for people who can buy, for people who might want to buy a sweet treat, a piece of candy, or maybe a can of soda or something for their kids. She said that, and this is a direct quote, "People who are on SNAP buy the same groceries that you and I buy. Sometimes we buy a treat, but not always." And I thought that was a very humane response to that.
But it's also it avoids the concern that a lot of people have, and that is that sometimes these benefits will be spent on a whole lot of junk food. Buying, quote, a treat, but not always, is one thing, but filling up your grocery cart with everything ultra-processed is a whole other thing.
And when I was a recipient of what is now called SNAP benefits, we did not fill up our carts ultra-processed.
And we didn't either.
And
but
some people do. I think it's discriminatory, though, because we don't have an overall program to help all the kids in Iowa avoid ultra-processed foods and, you know, high fructose corn syrup and such things. The point is to keep the people who are using SNAP benefits kind of in their place. Don't be a problem when it's not just those kids and those families with the problem. In fact, sometimes it's because they live in food deserts and don't have access to good groceries that they choose themselves that we have the problem. In food education, Senator Mike Zimmer, from a Democrat, said something akin to, "It would be great to have food education classes, but it's next to impossible to find the teachers in these areas." And he said it's not a simple fix. That was in response to Senator Sweeney's saying that she was going to once again push for a bill that requires a semester of food education in Iowa schools, teaching things like canning, gardening, food prep, and more.
Well, I like that.
I like the idea. I like the idea. We did just discuss last week about education, that schools are stressed to teach everything anyway.
Well, I agree with her on that. I'm not sure I agree with Senator Zimmer, the Democrat, that it's impossible to find teachers?
It's been very tough to find teachers. People are not going into teaching as much because of how difficult it is to teach in Iowa now. And teachers in that area, I guess in the what we would call home economics area.
Maybe we should pay them better.
Maybe we should pay them better. And there just are not teachers for that. So it would not be a quick fix.
Any quick comments from lawmakers on local food policies?
Yes. Senator Zimmer said something about food programs having to be supported, because as much as local schools would want to purchase food locally, good, wholesome local foods, they can't afford to do so without assistance. Whereas Representative Norlin Momsen, a Republican, said, quote, "If you are always going to wait for the government to do it, don't, because there was funding in these areas and now they're gone. So I would use creativity, and then whatever the government helps, that's gravy."
Well, at least we got gravy in there.
Well, I don't think it's groovy, no. Though, because obviously the government is not coming up with help.
Hey, thanks, Kathy, and thanks to my guests this week, Randy Evans. Thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dedeman, Charles Goldman, Kathy Burns, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks to our nonprofit partners. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.